each and every one had been hand-picked by Stephanie for their specific intellectual gifts, for their discerning taste, and, most important, for their ability to work with her. Cheryl, who'd introduced herself as a human capital consultant, getting the first snicker of the morning from Stephanie and her longtime assistant, Pilar, was leading them through the second icebreaker of the morning. The first had not gone well. It was the old classic, two truths and a lie. Stephanie'd endured it on several previous occasions, conferences and meetings, when everyone had to stand in front of the room and read three statements about themselves, two that were true, one a lie. And the rest of the group had to guess which was which. Stephanie always used the same three. I was in an Academy Award-winning movie. True. When she was 17, she'd worked for a caterer in Queens that provided craft services for the cast and crew of Goodfellas. She noticed Scorsese staring at her from beneath his Panama hat one day as she dumped an enormous bag of lettuce onto a white plastic platter. She smiled at him. He walked over, grabbed four oatmeal cookies from the table, and said, "Wanna be in a movie?" He sent her off to hair and makeup and used her as an extra for the Copacabana scene. 8 takes, all in one day. She stood for hours tottering on high heels and wearing a tight gold lamé dress and black mink stole, her hair teased into a mile-high twist. It was her red hair that Scorsese liked. He put her front and center in the shot where Ray Liotta guides Lorraine Bracco down the stairs to their table. I can butcher a pig. True, she spent one summer in high school at her uncle's farm in Vermont. She'd had a summer fling with the son of a local butcher and had spent her afternoons sitting on a metal stool watching his shoulder blades glide beneath his white coat, transfixed by how he could deftly break down a glistening side of beef or pork. He showed her how to slice along the fat line, spatchcock a chicken, separate a pork shoulder into butt and shank. They'd drive around town at night in his truck and drink wild turkey from tiny flowered Dixie cups, park near the pond, and touch each other until they were dizzy. She'd bring his substantial hands to her face and inhale, smells she still associated with heady New England nights, Castile soap and pennies, the coppery scent of animal blood. I was born in Dublin, Ireland. Lie, she was born in Bayside, Queens. But between her hair and brownish-greenish eyes, she looked like she could have been. Nobody ever guessed Ireland was the lie. They always went for the pig. The first participant that morning to stand in front of the room and read his truths and lie was a new hire from the interactive group. A gaunt 20-something wearing a vintage-looking cardigan and Clark Kent eyeglasses that magnified his smudged eyeliner. He had a tattoo of a squid down his left forearm. He stood, stoop-shouldered, and introduced himself.
Hey, I'm Gideon, and... Okay, well, here goes.
He shoved his hands in his pockets and read from the paper on the table in front of him in a quick, even monotone.
I nearly died from overdosing on pills. I nearly died from bleeding out. I nearly died from autoerotic asphyxiation.
Whoa, whoa, whoa! Cheryl jumped up, waving both hands before anyone had a chance to respond. Thank you, Gideon, for your candor. She paused for a beat. But I guess I should have spelled out the guidelines a little more clearly. We want you to reveal something interesting about yourself, but nothing quite that personal in nature. And please, everybody, nothing sexual. Think professional.
Sorry, Gideon had said, shrugging idly. Clinical depression and suicidal ideation are more common than most people realize, and they're both a really important part of who I am.
I understand. Cheryl kept a smile affixed to the lower half of her face. We're just going for something a little lighter here.
The lie was autoerotic asphyxiation, he'd added. FYI.
Stephanie opened her moleskin and tried to tune out the rest of the room as Cheryl asked for someone to read their four words. She started making a list of things she needed for dinner. You said not to self-edit,
An amiable guy spoke from the other end of the table. So this is what I've got. Fat, happy, golfer, husband. Her cell phone sitting on the table in front of her started to vibrate. Without even looking at the number, she waved at Cheryl. I have to take this, she mouthed and left the room as quietly as she could. Relief. She looked down at the incoming ID. Beatrice Plum. Standing in the hallway outside the meeting room, Stephanie was surprised to find how happy she was to hear Bee's voice. She begged off the phone quickly, telling Bee she wanted to talk but was in a meeting, true, and couldn't stay on the phone, true, and that, yes, Leo had mentioned something about new work, but they'd both been incredibly busy and maybe they'd talk about it tonight. Why? Bee sounded so anxious that Stephanie found herself feeling protective. Maternal, almost. She didn't know if Leo had read Bee's stuff. She doubted it. But she could ask. She briefly wondered why Bee had handed the pages to Leo and not her. But then again, they probably weren't new pages. They were probably old pages that she was passing off as new, and Leo wouldn't know the difference. Stephanie would remind Leo to read them, and she would help him come up with something to say to Bee, something nice and noncommittal. She'd put it on her list. Back in the conference room, Gideon was up again, this time reading his four words. Musician, pessimist, wizard, Democrat. A slight wave of nausea roiled her stomach. She sipped the lemon water she'd brought into the meeting. She was going to have to eat something soon. She slid her phone out of her jacket pocket to check the time. Once it was in her hand, she couldn't resist opening the app she'd downloaded that tracked the development of the baby based on due date. This week, your baby is the size of an apple seed. This week, your baby is as big as an almond. This week, an olive. She hit the button and watched the photo appear of what her embryo looked like at 9 weeks. Like a tiny bay shrimp. A curled crustacean with an immense head and sci-fi budding arms. As she did almost every time she looked at the eerie images, she felt herself blush. It was unseemly, really. How addled she found herself to be 41 and single and accidentally pregnant by Leo Plum. Beyond a shadow of a doubt, the most irresponsible and least paternal of all the men she'd ever loved her entire life. She knew it was crazy, told herself a million times a day that it was crazy, but she found she couldn't completely suppress a few fleeting moments of optimism. About the baby, for sure. About Leo? Maybe. She was surprised by how responsible he'd been lately, how present. He helped around the house. He seemed to be working every day and was enthused about meeting with Nathan. He read all the time. Nothing in his behavior made her believe he was anything other than completely clean and sober. She couldn't help but wonder if everything in her life had been pitched toward this moment. Agency sold, money in the bank, some time on her hands, a seemingly renewed Leo in her bed, trying to make some kind of amends to someone or something. That she was on the receiving end of this newly burnished Leo. The very thing she desired and abandoned as so much wasted effort all those years ago. Leo in the living room scribbling on a legal pad. Leo in her bed in the morning running a finger down her back. Leo in her kitchen every night closing a book and pulling her onto his lap. Well, she'd decided not to question it. She'd decided to selfishly, greedily take it. All of it. Maybe even this new wrinkle. The unexpected residue of the power outage. Over the years, she'd considered having a baby with any number of people. Marriage was not part of her plan. She wasn't against it, she just wasn't for it. She treated her occasional yearning for a baby the same way she treated her occasional yearning for a dog. Let it linger and wait to see if it passed, which it always did, which she took as a good sign. Because other things she desired, her house, a particular author signed, a mid-century table in good condition, didn't flit through. They planted themselves until she turned a desire into ownership. That her fleeting thoughts of motherhood never truly haunted her the way, say, her quest for the magenta peony bushes in her yard did, was comforting as she imagined her ovaries surrendering the final vestiges of fertile eggs into the hinterlands of her reproductive system. Then, the storm. The expected, unexpected arrival of Leo. The power outage. Leo. A little too much wine, hers. The familiar mouth, his. Leo had seemed the tiniest bit broken. She made him laugh. They talked. He took her wrists and circled them with his thumb and forefinger, pulling her to him. The way he had that first night, their friendship became something else. The night he turned to her in a hidden booth at a small burger joint and said, "I've been wondering what you keep beneath your blouse." And then he two-stepped her across her kitchen in the dark under the moonlight and kissed her with such acquisitive purpose she thought she might combust. Leo. What else was there to do when the lights were out, wind howling, branches splitting and falling, but fuel the fire, let him lift the sweater over her head, unzip her pants, and fuck her silly under the unblinking, marbled gaze of Lillian? She looked back down at the list she'd written. Her four words. She was going to have to talk to Leo very soon. Whatever he said, whatever his reaction, the decision was hers. This belonged to her. She took the cap off her pen and crossed out, single, wrote, "Mother." It didn't look terrible. Chapter 22. When Matilda was recovering in the hospital and found out how much money she was getting from the Plum family, she'd had all kinds of fantasies about what to do with it. Shamefully, she remembered that her first involuntary thought was a pair of suede boots she'd coveted, the ones that went over the knee and stopped mid-thigh. Then she remembered. She thought about trips and clothes and cars and flat-screen televisions. She thought about buying her sister her own beauty salon, which she'd always wanted. She thought about buying her mother a divorce. The staff at the rehabilitation hospital tried to prepare her for all her future expenses, not just her prosthetic foot, which would need to be replaced every few years, and its various related medical issues and costs, but the accommodations she'd have to make to her home. "It sounds like your living situation is not ideal," one of the social workers said to her. "You might need to reassess." Matilda took the financial worksheets and nodded her head, but she didn't really listen. Everything seemed so much sunnier at the rehab hospital where she was a little bit of a star, so young and determined and doggedly cheerful. She learned each skill quickly and was able to go home sooner than most patients. When she returned to her parents' cramped apartment in the Bronx, Matilda started to understand what she was up against. The problems began at the building's front door, which opened to three flights of stained, uneven, peeling linoleum stairs that were discouraging in the best of circumstances, but were horrific with crutches and wouldn't be much better once her prosthetic foot was ready. Inside the apartment to the left of the front door was a corridor, too narrow for a wheelchair, which she sometimes needed, especially at night, leading to the apartment's one bathroom and galley kitchen. Straight ahead, four small steps down, was the sunken living area that 13-year-old two-footed Matilda believed was the height of design sophistication, and now made amputee Matilda want to weep in frustration. And there was her mother's decor, what she and her sister used to call south-of-the-border kitsch, mismatched throw rugs from Mexico, colorful baskets full of fabric, tiny rickety tables holding religious statuary. All of it now seemed like a concerted effort to kill her. Small things she'd never noticed about the apartment loomed large. The toilet was very low. The shower required stepping over the side of a challengingly deep bathtub. There were no railings, not even a towel bar for her to grab onto. Beyond the physical discomfort with the apartment and the utter lack of privacy, which was psychologically draining, there was the emotional stress of being around her two parents. Even though they'd been unusually kind to each other in the wake of the accident, uniting in their worry and grief for the first time in years, They never left her alone. They watched her move around the rooms guardedly, her mother clutching a rosary, her father trying to avert his gaze. She had to get out of there. Matilda didn't believe in God as much as she believed in signs. She knew she'd gotten a sign the night of the accident in the front seat of Leo Plum's Porsche, the setting sun glinting off his wedding ring, and she'd ignored it. And now look at her. God had taken her right foot. She said a rosary every morning when she woke, praying to know what to do, where to live. So when she saw the billboard in front of a brand new condominium complex on her favorite street, the one lined with cherry trees that bloomed exuberantly in the spring, she knew. The sign was her sign. "Prices slashed," it said, and in tiny print on the bottom, "Accessible units available." She bought two apartments, one on an upper floor for her sister who had three kids and a deadbeat husband, and a smaller one on the ground floor for herself. She paid cash, only asking her sister to cover her own maintenance costs. The leftover money had still seemed monumental. A lawyer friend of Fernando's helped her open a money market account attached to her checking. She was being as frugal as she could, but it went so fast. And someone in her family was always asking her for a loan, a down payment for a car, plane tickets to visit family back in Mexico, a new dress for a daughter's prom. It never ended, and how could she say no? She couldn't. Because when she thought about why she had the money, she was ashamed. And now she was scared, because she had to find a way to be more mobile. She had to get a job. Once the morphine from the night of the accident wore off, she admitted what she'd always known. She'd never be a singer. "You're smart, Matilda," one of the nurses in rehab said to her. "What kind of career are you thinking about?" Nobody had ever used that word with her before. Career. She liked the sound of it. She liked imagining herself going to an office every day. After high school, she'd wanted to go to college, but there was no money. And the day she'd come home, excited after her allotted 15 minutes with one of the school's overworked counselors, with community college applications and student loan forms, her parents had been so negative, so discouraging. She knew they were afraid of their undocumented status, of being found out and losing their jobs. She heard them later that night arguing over whether to let her apply, her father becoming increasingly angry and volatile. The next day she'd asked Fernando about catering work. Now she had some money. She could take classes if she wanted, but not if she was on crutches or in constant pain. Vinny wasn't the first person during her stay at the rehabilitation hospital to mention elective amputation to Matilda. Not the first person to gently suggest, or in Vinny's case aggressively suggest, that as far as amputations went, hers was a particularly shitty one and she should consider another operation to amputate below the knee, which would open up a world of better prosthetics. Matilda didn't understand because at first everyone had seemed so excited by how much of her leg had been saved. She didn't remember much from the recovery room, but she did remember the surgeon triumphantly telling her that he'd taken as little bone as possible. When she repeated his boast to her physical therapist, who was examining her stump and frowning, the woman said, "Sometimes more bone is a good thing, and sometimes it's not." She was right. Matilda's prosthetic foot hurt almost all the time. No matter how she paced herself or rested or how hard she worked to strengthen her body's other muscles, no matter how many or few barrier socks she wore or how much therapeutic massage she had, after only an hour or two with the foot, her stump would start to throb, the pain gradually working its way up her calf and then past her knee, until there was a concentrated knot of tension and an almost unbearable ache at the top of her hamstring where it joined her lower gluteal muscles. How blissfully ignorant she'd been of the infrastructure of upper thigh to ass before the accident, only wondering if there was a cure for the tiny cellulite bumps that peeked out from her very short shorts. Most days the pain would creep into her hip, Many days her neck would start to ache by late afternoon and she'd end up in bed before dinner. Her doorbell rang, loud and insistent, angry. Vinny. Matilda opened the door to find him standing there with a pizza box balanced on his left arm and a full-length mirror tucked under his bionic arm. She eyed the long mirror warily when he came through the door.
"I don't want that thing in here," she said.
"Maybe you don't want it, but you need it. Your foot is bad, right?" He could tell just by looking at her how much pain she was in. She would still laugh and smile, but her eyes would be unfocused. He understood.
"It's not too bad," Matilda lied.
On good days, Matilda's non-existent foot would tingle, or just feel like it was there, its ghostly presence driving her crazy. But on bad days, it hurt to distraction. Today, it felt like needles were piercing her non-existent foot. For weeks, she'd had a persistent itch on one of her missing toes. She found herself in the ludicrous position of fantasizing about amputating a foot that didn't exist.
"Sit down," Vinny said, placing the pizza on her kitchen table. "Take a slice while it's hot. You can eat while we do this."
She reluctantly sat on one of her kitchen chairs, took a slice and blew a little before she bit into it.
"How did you manage to get it here while it's still hot?" she asked him.
"Trade secret," he said.
"What's in the sauce that makes this so good anyway?"
"Nice try. We can talk my miracle sauce later. Let's do some work." Vinny had been talking about mirror therapy for weeks, and Matilda thought it sounded ridiculous, like voodoo. Still, he was in front of her and he'd carted a mirror all the way to her house, so she reluctantly did what he said. She straightened her knees and let Vinny position the mirror between them, so that when she looked down, she saw her intact foot on one side and its mirrored image on the other.
"Oh," she said.
"Move your left foot," Vinny said. She did, and the optical illusion was of two perfect feet moving in concert. "Scratch your toe," he said, "the one that's been itching."
"How?"
He pointed. "Scratch the itchy spot on your left foot, but keep looking in the mirror." She leaned over and gently scratched.
"Oh my God," she said, "it helps."
She scratched harder. "I can't believe it helps. I don't understand." "Nobody understands, really. The simple way to think about it is that you're helping to rewire the old signals in your brain. You're teaching your brain a new story." She moved her foot to the left and to the right, flexed and pointed and flexed again. She wiggled her toes. She rotated her ankle and the foot in the mirror, her missing foot, seemed like it was back and was working. She scratched again. It helped again.
"It already feels better," she said. "Not great, but different."
"Good. 4 or 5 times a week for 15 minutes. And use the mirror whenever the foot hurts or itches. Got it?" Matilda nodded and smiled.
"It sounded so stupid," she said. "I didn't want to go buy a mirror just to do something that sounded so dumb."
"Thank you, Poppy," she said. She spoke softly and put a light hand on his shoulder.
"Thank you for bringing the mirror."
"It's temporary," Vinny said, standing abruptly. The charge that shot through his arm, his chest, and other places he didn't want to dwell on when Matilda touched him was dismaying.
"I'll buy my own. You can have this back."
"No, no," he said. "I don't mean the mirror is temporary. It's yours. I bought it for you. I mean you still need to deal with the underlying problem." He sounded angrier than he intended. Matilda was frowning. He took a breath. Stop. Rewind. He started again, keeping his voice even. "The mirror is just a temporary fix, is what I meant." In her heart, Matilda knew Vinny was right. Of all the things people had said to her over the past 6 months, all the useless advice and meaningless platitudes, "God never gives you more than you can handle," "everything happens for a reason," and quoting of Bible verses, what Vinny said about elective amputation and losing her ankle made the most sense. Matilda grew up knowing that you didn't get anything without giving something up. In her world, that was the prevailing logic.
It was just a matter of knowing how much you were willing to lose, how many pounds of flesh, which in her case would be literal. If thy foot offend thee, cast it off. That Bible verse she understood. When she was in rehab, one of the nurses told her Vinny was someone they called a super user. He healed so swiftly and learned so fast that he'd been chosen to test the cutting-edge prosthetic he wore. And here she was, barely able to hobble around on her clunky, ugly rubber foot. She was the opposite of Vinny. She wasn't a super user. She was a super loser. But more surgery? More rehab? Better prosthetics? It would all cost money. A lot of money. I don't have that kind of insurance. I don't have that kind of money. And I don't know anyone who does, Matilda said. She sounded defeated, resigned. Yes, you do, Vinny said. You do. It had taken Vinny a few tries, but before he took the mirror to Matilda, he'd managed to convince her cousin Fernando to meet with him privately. Fernando was suspicious at first, and Vinny quickly realized the source of all the wariness, the secrecy and protectiveness around Matilda. Fear of deportation. Vinny slowly pulled the story from Fernando, the wedding, the ride in the fancy car, the emergency room, the hastily called meeting in an attorney's office only days later, the rush to sign papers and take the check, the refusal to fight Leo Plum in court or insist on an insurance claim. The family wanted to avoid a police report because a police report would mean that Matilda's parents and Fernando's mother, who was also illegal, not to mention most of the rest of their extended family, would come to the attention of the immigration authorities, as George Plum had repeatedly threatened, according to Fernando. Vinny tried to understand exactly what kind of agreement Matilda had signed, in the hospital, hopped up on morphine. It was ridiculous, a travesty. He finally convinced Fernando that a conversation with Leo Plum was not going to incite legal action. I just want to have a friendly chat with him, Vinny said. Fernando had burst out laughing. You understand why that doesn't sound entirely plausible to me. Fernando had almost punched Vinny the day he yelled at Matilda in the pizza parlor. He didn't trust the guy. I swear to you, Vinny said, on my mother's grave, I wouldn't do anything to hurt Matilda. You have to believe me, I would never, ever bring harm to Matilda. Fernando did believe that part because Vinny was clearly head over heels. And Fernando also felt a not insignificant amount of guilt about the weeks following the accident. He had panicked. They all had. He'd been blinded by the sum of money the Plums were offering as much as anyone, and was ashamed to think of how Matilda had helped him pay off some of his law school loans. He'd been so relieved, he'd barely protested. Okay, he finally said to Vinny. But you have to tell Matilda what you're planning, and she has to agree. Promise me you will tread carefully. You have my word, Vinny said. He wasn't scared of anyone, and the mysterious Leo Plum sure didn't intimidate him. He respected Fernando's hesitation, but he knew without ever having to meet him what kind of a person Leo Plum was. He was a fucking coward. Matilda was so full of shame about the night of the accident she couldn't see clearly, but Vinny could. What kind of person leaves his wife at a wedding and lures a young girl out to his car with a lie? What kind of person doesn't even think twice about driving given his blood alcohol and drug levels? What kind of person doesn't fucking apologize and check on the girl who, because of his spectacular hard-on, no longer has a foot? A coward, that's who. And here was another thing Vinny knew about cowards. They were easy to break. Vinny had a plan. He was going to request a meeting with Leo Plum and make it clear they weren't after money because they weren't. Vinny wanted access. He'd done his research and he knew Leo had traveled in the right circles. Leo could put Matilda in touch with the right people and help her with any number of programs where she would get assistance with her prosthetics, including further surgery if necessary. He wanted Leo to pull some strings, and he wasn't going to give him a choice. He was going to make it clear that he wasn't afraid to expose him for the coward he was. He'd put on his uniform, stand with Matilda at his side, and humiliate Leo Plum until he buckled. Leo could come after him and Vinny would welcome that fight, but he'd never have to engage. Because the other thing he knew about cowards? They were most afraid of being unmasked. This was going to be easy.
"No," Matilda said. "Absolutely not."
She'd let the mirror fall to the floor and she was furiously hopping across the kitchen. "I'm not going to talk about this."
"We're going to talk about it." Vinny stood firm.
"Get out of here, please. Thank you for the pizza, the mirror. I'm tired and I want..."
"This," Vinny said, pointing to Matilda's stump, "is bullshit."
Matilda had her back to him, holding on to the kitchen sink.
"Why are you yelling?" she said, turning to him. "Why are you always fighting, always mad at everyone and everything?"
"Why aren't you?"
In the harsh light of Matilda's kitchen, Vinny's left hand was clenching and unclenching.
"Why aren't you fucking pissed off?"
"Because it doesn't do any good."
"I disagree."
"Maybe you need to tell your brain a new story. Go ahead. Use the mirror. Take a look at your face and see how ugly it is when you're mad."
He took a deep breath and then he slammed his palm against the refrigerator next to her. She flinched.
"Why aren't you mad enough to ask for what you deserve?" he said.
She sat down heavily on one of the kitchen chairs, her face drawn and bleak. She looked like she might cry. Vinny had never seen her cry. Matilda couldn't even look at Vinny. She'd tried so many times to will herself back into that pantry, back into the before, when Leo was waltzing her to the music. If only she could do it all over again. Disengage. Walk away from Leo and back to Fernando in the kitchen and pick up her squeeze bottle of vinaigrette. She looked up, somber.
"I can't ask for more because I did get what I deserved," she said. "I got exactly what I deserved."
Chapter 23 Nathan Chowdhury had been livid when Leo wanted to sell Speakeasy Media.
"It's Oz," he said. "We made the fucking thing, and it's finally doing well and getting bigger and better, and now you want to hand it over to a bunch of corporate drones? Why? And do what?"
Nathan had argued for weeks, but Leo held firm, and Nathan couldn't afford to buy Leo's half of the business.
"I'm done," Leo told Nathan. "I'm out."
Leo was tired. Tired of working around the clock and the crappy offices that were one step up from his living room, but barely. Tired of the young, clever, petulant, glorified interns they employed and had to manage in every conceivable way. Leo felt like a house mother half the time. He'd walked into the tiny conference room twice in one week to find two different couples making out. Someone was constantly letting food go to mold in the tiny refrigerator. The sink was always full of dirty coffee mugs. He was tired of being broke, tired of running into friends from college and hearing about expensive trips and shares in the Hamptons and admiring their nicer clothes, tired of not wanting anyone to visit his apartment because it was still the depressingly nondescript post-war one-bedroom that he'd always illegally sublet, a second-floor apartment where every window looked out onto a neighboring roof of below-code air-conditioning compressors. The rooms actually rattled when they were all going at once. He was tired of gossip. God, was he tired of gossip. By the time he sold it, Speakeasy Media had fully morphed into the very thing Leo most loathed. It had become a pathetic parody of itself, not any more admirable or honest or transparent than the many publications and people they ruthlessly ridiculed, 22 to 34 times a day to be exact. That was the number the accountants had come up with, how many daily posts they needed on each of their 14 sites to generate enough click-throughs to keep the advertisers happy. An absurd amount. A number that meant they had to give prominence to the mundane,
shine a spotlight of mockery on the unlucky and often undeserving, publishing stories that were immediately forgotten except by the poor sods who'd been fed to the ever-hungry machine that was speakeasy media. The cockroaches of the Internet, one national magazine had dubbed them, illustrating the article with a cartoon drawing of Leo as King Roach. He was tired of being King Roach. The numbers the larger media company dangled seemed huge to Leo, who was also, at that particular moment, besotted with his new publicist, Victoria Gross, who had come from money and was accustomed to money, and looked around the room of Leo's tiny apartment the first time she visited, as if she'd just stepped into a homeless shelter. "When you said you lived near Gramercy," she said, confused, "I thought you'd have a key to the park or something." Heading to his meeting with Nathan, Leo remembered what it was like to be charged with adrenaline, optimistically nervous. He almost walked right past Nathan, who was sitting at the bar in front of an open laptop, head bent. Leo was glad to have a minute to observe his old friend, his years-long companion in the pursuit of business and pleasure and a winning season for the Jets. The welling affection he felt at seeing Nathan's familiar profile was genuine. Nathan, who had a seemingly endless ability to stare at spreadsheets and pie charts and see a story. Nathan, who was still wearing his pants too short and his jacket a little tight, and drinking his standard drink, a Shirley Temple. And when Nathan looked up, he was visibly happy to see Leo, too. He stood, and they hugged. Not the back-slapping hug Leo was used to, the bro hug that was more exuberant handshake and head dip than body contact, but a true hug. Nathan drew Leo close and held him tight, and Leo was unnerved to feel himself tear up. Anyone watching might mistake their moment of reunion for something sadder. Then they straightened, did the hearty backslap, and took a few seconds to appraise each other. Nathan grinned, nodding. "Yep, yep, I'm still the better-looking one, by many fathoms." This was a long-running joke. To say Nathan was not conventionally handsome was generous. For a big guy, his shoulders were unusually narrow, and all his weight gathered around his midsection. He had the kind of pear-shaped body more common on women. The enormous gap between his two front teeth managed to be charming. His hair was completely gone, but the bald head worked with his strong features, the fleshy nose, the severely arched brows that nearly had a life of their own. "Want a real one of those?" Leo said, pointing to Nathan's drink and ordering himself a whiskey. "Afraid not. I have precisely 20 minutes until I have to leave for an uptown charity thing, and I'm introducing someone, so..." Leo was not encouraged to hear that he'd been apportioned such a tiny slice of Nathan's day. He'd have to talk fast. He went through the motions, asked after Nathan's family, saw a few photos, listened to a recap of his nightmare townhouse renovation. "I heard about you and Victoria," Nathan said. "I'm sorry." "Don't be. It's better for both of us." Leo hoped he hit the right mix of reassurance and regret. He was glad Nathan brought up the divorce. He wanted to use it. "You were right back then when you told me we brought out the worst in each other." Nathan plucked the bright cherry out of his ginger ale and ate it, chewing on the stem. "I don't take any satisfaction in being right about that." "I know. Just coming clean with an old friend. I should have listened to you. And not just about Victoria. About a lot of things." "Water under the bridge," Nathan said. "You look good. And unless the grapevine is just desperately gnawing on very old intel, I think I heard something about you and Stephanie. True?"
"True. Yes. For now. We're going slowly, but it's good so far."
"I'm happy for you, mate. Don't fuck it up this time."
"I'm not planning to," Leo said, bristling a little at the sanctimonious comment. Nathan had fucked up plenty of relationships in his day. "I'm ready to get back in the game, so to speak. That's one of the reasons I wanted to see you."
"I thought as much. I've heard you've been dropping my name around town, telling people we're working together."
"That's not true," Leo said, stunned that his movements had already been reported to Nathan. "I've heard it from more than one person."
Stephanie told me about your idea and I was curious. Really curious, I'm interested. I've been making calls and doing research and asking questions, but I never misrepresented myself. I never told anyone I was working with you or that we had any official affiliation. The conclusions people draw on their own when they hear my name and your name are not my doing. Nathan stared at Leo for a few minutes, assessing.
Okay. I see how that's possible. I hope it's true.
It is true.
Because I can't hire you.
Can we back up a little? Leo couldn't believe he'd lost control of the conversation so quickly. Can we start over? I know you're busy and I came prepared.
I'm confused as to why you'd want to be involved with this fairly modest project I'm considering.
It doesn't sound modest, it sounds ambitious and worthwhile.
Believe me, it's modest.
It also sounds like something that was once my idea.
Leo stopped. He hadn't intended to bring that up at all, and certainly not so quickly. He couldn't let Nathan rattle him.
Nathan looked up at the ceiling, as if seeking for patience from above.
You hardly invented the concept of an online literary magazine. Don't go Al Gore on me, Leo.
I know. I'm sorry that came out wrong. We have the experience. We were a good team. You don't even want to hear my thoughts? You know what I can do.
Now Nathan let go his booming laugh. Leo was unnerved by how casual he seemed, how matter-of-fact.
Sadly, that is very, very true. Let me just give you a quick overview, how I think you could expand paper fibers in some really interesting and fruitful ways.
Leo opened up his folder and took out the stack of printed pages.
Jesus, Nathan said. Did you make a PowerPoint deck?
Leo ignored him, paging through the sheets in front of him and pulled out one with a mocked-up logo.
Right down to an event-based app that would also push content.
Leo put the page in front of Nathan, who stared at it, confused.
An app?
You've got to have an app.
This is not news to me, Leo. Every 16-year-old in New York City is trying to build an app.
Leo said, That's one tiny element. I have an entire...
Nathan interrupted. Leo, I appreciate that you put thought into this, and I'm genuinely thrilled to find out you're with Stephanie, really. When I heard that, I thought, okay. Whatever shit has gone down for the last few years, he's got his head back on straight, and I hope you do. I hope you find a gig that makes you happy. But even if I wanted to work with you, and I don't, I need someone young who will work for next to nothing. Someone who is already up to speed and isn't...
Nathan gestured dismissively at the page in front of him. Breaking ground with an event app.
But what about experience? What about name recognition?
Name recognition? Nathan was incredulous.
That, my friend, is part of the problem. What have you done since we sold Speakeasy?
Seriously, Leo, what have you done?
What had he done?
First, he and Victoria had lived in Paris for 6 months, and then Florence, all without improving his French or Italian one iota. Those days and weeks were long blurs of visiting friends and meals and trips to the country that somehow he ended up paying for. Then Victoria declared New York boring, so they went west and leased an apartment in Santa Monica for a few years. He was supposed to be working on a screenplay, but he really went to the beach every day and tried to surf and then got stoned, while Victoria spent a lot of time meditating and doing some kind of aromatherapy shit. They talked incessantly about opening up a small art gallery, but never did. When her dermatologist found a precancerous mole on her otherwise unblemished décolletage, it was back to New York where she convinced him to fund a small theater group downtown so they could nurture emerging talent, which pretty much meant Victoria producing and starring in bad plays written by people she'd grown up with in the West Village. He'd gone for long walks and taught himself all about single-barrel whiskey. He read, quietly resenting anything he deemed good. He spent months designing a custom bike that he never rode.
I wish I'd done a lot of things differently, Leo said. But I can't go back in time.
I agree,
Nathan said. You and me?
He wagged a finger between the two of them. That's trying to move back in time. We had a good run.
He slapped Leo on the arm, hard. Leo winced. A bloody good run.
Leo knew the meeting was over when Nathan amped up the Briticisms. He watched Nathan gather his folders and slide his laptop into a briefcase.
I'll have my assistant call you. We'll have dinner. You, me, my wife, Stephanie.
It will be fun. You can come uptown to take a look at the massive money pit and laugh at my folly.
Leo hadn't had a chance to say anything he'd planned.
Let's reschedule. I realize now I should have sent you my ideas ahead of this meeting.
This isn't a meeting. Nathan tossed a credit card on the bar, started pulling on his coat.
Now Leo was annoyed. He deserved better. Come on, Nathan. Don't be like this.
Like what, in a hurry?
Leo tried to think of what he could say to persuade Nathan to stay. The credit card on the bar was a black Amex. Leo couldn't believe Nathan was doing that well.
Do you need money? Nathan asked, noticing Leo staring at the card.
What?
No.
Because if this is about money, I can float you alone. I can do that.
It's not about money. Christ, why would you think I need money?
Leo was furious, remembering that he had thought about borrowing money from Nathan. Hell would have to freeze over.
I talk to Victoria now and then.
Fantastic. Fucking fantastic. Victoria, the most unreliable narrator of all time.
To her credit, I had to drag the information out of her.
It's not to her credit. She signed an agreement. In fact, I find it very interesting that she's trying to turn people against me.
Cut the bull, Leo. I asked about you as a friend. I was worried. Nobody's against you.
Leo took a deep breath. So put me on your calendar. Let me give you my presentation. Just hear me out.
You say you've done your homework, Nathan said.
I have.
So you know who our CFO is?
I didn't memorize the organization chart, no.
Peter Rothstein.
Nathan signed the bar copy and started ripping his receipt into tiny pieces, which he carefully placed back on the edge of the plastic bill tray. Leo frantically tried to remember why the name might be significant. Nothing.
His brother was Ari Rothstein, Nathan said.
Leo felt a vague, familiar nagging, but still nothing.
Do I know him?
That's one way to put it. The one who gets it done? Sound familiar?
Leo's heart sank.
Ari Rothstein had been one of the last speakeasy stories of his tenure. A community college kid, kind of portly, dull-looking, who sent in a video resume for a tech support job. Leo had come to the office one morning to find everyone standing around a monitor, hooting and laughing. The tape started with Ari Rothstein in an ill-fitting suit reeling off his technical experience, and then absurdly and awkwardly interrupting himself by removing his jacket, putting on a baseball cap, and singing a nonsensical rap parody about tech support. The chorus was the inelegant and forgettable, I'm the one to get it done, I'm the one, I'm the one, I'm the one to get it done. It was awful and hilarious.
We're putting it on the site, Leo had said before he'd even watched the entire 4 minutes and 32 seconds. Everyone thought he was kidding at first, but he knew click-through gold when he saw it. It was Speakeasy Media's first huge viral video, and Ari Rothstein had been vilified and mocked for weeks, everywhere, online, in print, on television. His clip ended up on a Today Show segment called How Not to Get That Job You Really Want.
You hired that guy?
No, Nathan drew out the word as if he were talking to someone incredibly dim. That guy is dead. He overdosed a few years ago. His brother was with the company before they acquired us, and he didn't speak to me for more than a year. It took a long time to gain his trust, convince him that I didn't have anything to do with the incident and that I regretted it, which I do.
What we did back then? It was okay, it was fun. But it wasn't exactly honorable, Leo.
It's not what I want to be remembered for.
I don't either.
That's my point. I can't, Leo. I can't. I'm not saying the Ari thing is your fault, our fault, or anything like that. I'm saying things are different. The business world is different. I'm different. I hope you're different, and I can't hire you.
Leo sat for the first time since entering the bar. He was trying to think of the right thing to say, the sensitive and appropriate thing. But what came out instead was a joke, one the old Nathan might have found amusing.
I guess Ari Rothstein really was the one to get it done.
After a long silence, Nathan said, I'm going to pretend you didn't say that.
Good luck, Leo. Sorry to disappoint you. Don't be. I have other irons in the fire.
Good.
Not that you asked, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that in my opinion, you should have some concerns about throwing your financial efforts behind Paul Underwood.
Is that right?
I like paper fibers too, but things are completely chaotic over there. I don't think Paul has the kind of leadership you're going to need to bring this forward. I don't think he's your guy.
Nathan stared at the floor and then slowly looked back up at Leo, pityingly.
I was hoping you wouldn't show up here and still be a prick, Leo. I was really hoping.
Don't misunderstand, I like Paul.
Nathan put out his hand and Leo reluctantly stood and shook it.
Best of luck, Leo. I hope you get your shit together for Stephanie's sake.
I'm going to have to take my ideas elsewhere.
Be my guest. Just don't ever drop my name again.
Fuck you, Nathan.
Right back at you, mate.
Leo watched Nathan make his way out the bar. He sat back down and took a deep breath, trying to process what had just happened. His phone on the bar started vibrating. He looked at the incoming call display, and at seeing the name, his heart nearly stopped. Matilda Rodriguez. Chapter 24. Before he'd stupidly let Jack Plum inside his house, Tommy had had only one scare concerning the kiss. An FBI unit had knocked on his door one morning when he still lived out in the Rockaways, wanting to talk to him about a missing object from the World Trade Site. He'd almost passed out until they explained that they were investigating reported thefts at Fresh Kills, and just wanted to know if Tommy remembered seeing the Rodin, and, if so, where he'd seen it last. Tommy assured the investigator that he'd delivered it to the Port Authority trailer, just like he had with countless other artifacts, and left it with someone there whose name he didn't remember, but who had said she'd take care of it.
"That's the last time I saw it, sorry, guys," he told them. "Wish I could be more of a help. Looks like a banged-up piece of crap, to be honest."
The investigator shook his hand, told him how sorry they were for his loss, and that was the last he heard from anyone. At first, Tommy kept the statue hidden in his bedroom closet in the house in Queens, covered with a pillowcase. He didn't want his daughters to see it when they visited, approximately 1,000 times a week.
"Just checking in," they always said in chirpy voices he'd never heard them employ until he was a widower.
But having his wife's gift in a closet like a shameful secret bothered him. He started to think about moving. The house he'd shared with Ronnie, where they'd raised their children, where they'd had family movie night with popcorn every Friday, and had managed to make love every Sunday even when the girls were little, sometimes having to fit it in between commercial breaks on Nickelodeon, but they did. They always did. Was too empty. Too lonely. His old friend Will from the fire department told him about Stephanie needing a new tenant. He'd always liked Stephanie. She was a good egg, funny and smart, a hard worker, and completely down to earth. "What they used to call a real dame," Ronnie had said approvingly when Will brought her to one of their legendary holiday parties, and Stephanie had charmed the entire room by singing, "Christmas baby, please come home, darling love style," into the karaoke machine they'd hooked up to their TV. The garden apartment was a little run down, but he didn't need much. He just wanted his own place where he could keep the statue and see it every day. Somewhere far enough from the Rockaways so his kids wouldn't drop by without calling first, where he wouldn't have to answer a lot of questions.
The statue had been his well-kept secret. Until Jack Plum walked into his dining room. Having Jack Plum inside his house, walking in circles around the statue like he was evaluating a used car, had caused an unpleasant shift in Tommy. Maybe it wasn't only Jack. Maybe it was the passing of time, the nature of grief. But when he took the statue out of its hiding place now, all he could hear was Jack Plum saying, "Where did you get this?" For years, Tommy had worried about somebody seeing the statue, his daughters mostly. And now that someone had, he started to think more clearly about what might happen if he was caught. He hadn't looked at the statue in more than a week. Today, two of his three daughters were visiting. He almost always went to them, but a few times a year they planned a trip into the city, and would detour to Tommy's place first, delivering bags of groceries they imagined he needed. His family never managed to hide their dismay at his living conditions, and as Maggie and Val barged through the front door, five grandchildren between them now, he braced himself for their familiar complaints and pinched mouths. "This place could be nice, Dad," Val said for the 100th time, "if you put in a little effort." She was unloading groceries onto the kitchen shelves, opening up a package of bright green sponges and using one to wipe down the cabinetry. "You don't have to do that," Tommy said. "Sit."
"I don't mind," she said.
"Why don't you get some furniture that actually fits in here?" Maggie said. "We could go look for a new sofa today if you want. We could help you pick something out."
She was right. The sofa he'd kept was meant for a much larger room, not the narrow proportions of a brownstone parlor. "I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm not expecting Better Homes and Gardens to drop by and take photos."
"Why is this locked?"
Val was standing now in front of the built-in china cabinet in the dining room. The top half was meant for display, and Tommy had put a few pieces of their wedding china on the shelves, his one attempt at decorating. The bottom half of the cabinet was meant for storage. He'd removed the interior shelves and the bottom baseboard, but left the doors in place to conceal the cavernous interior, which neatly fit the statue on its dolly. He could wheel it in and out when he wanted. The doors were padlocked now.
"It's nothing, a few valuables."
"Mom's stuff?"
Maggie had an edge to her voice.
"Everything that belonged to Mom is in the boxes I gave you, like I've told you."
She was staring at the cabinet.
"Is this neighborhood that bad? You need to padlock valuables?"
He didn't know how to answer. The neighborhood was fine. So he just made a dismissive sound and tried to move everyone back to the living room.
"Oh, my God," Maggie said. She grabbed his arm and spoke quietly so the kids wouldn't hear. "Do you have a gun in there?"
"What?"
"You look as guilty as sin. You have a goddamn gun in this house? The house where we bring your grandchildren?"
"There's no gun. Calm down. And I don't like your tone, young lady. I'm still your father." Tommy was desperate to distract her from the cabinet.
"What else do you own that you need to keep under lock and key in an empty dining room?"
Maggie's youngest son, Ron, named for the grandmother he'd never met, was clinging to his mother's leg and whimpering.
"What?" she asked, bending down and making her voice bright. "What's wrong, Peanut?"
"I don't like it here."
"Don't be silly," she said. "This is Grandpa's house."
"I like his old house better."
Tommy didn't know what to say, so he just watched Maggie stroking the child's head, comforting him.
"Let's have some lunch and then we'll go for a nice walk," she said. "There's a park nearby with a playground, right, Dad?"
But Ron couldn't be soothed.
"This house isn't friendly," he said, crying in earnest now.
He whispered something into Maggie's ear, and she shook her head and hugged him tight.
"No, no, baby, that's not true. Everything here is friendly."
Val took the kids into the kitchen to make lunch, and Maggie pulled Tommy aside.
"Dad, I've got to tell you there is something wrong about..."
She waved her arm, taking in the surroundings. The misfit furniture, the leftovers from previous tenants, the dust and disorder.
"All this, after all this time."
"I'm one person," Tommy said. It's all I need.
I'm not talking about space.
She crossed her arms and he could tell she was steeling herself to say something difficult. She looked so much like her mother he had to stop himself from staring at, touching her face.
Do you know what Ron said when he was crying? He said this felt like a haunted house, like there was a ghost here. I mean, he's a kid, but kids pick up on things. It's dark and dreary and depressing. At least buy some lights, a couple of floor lamps, up your wattage.
She pointed to the lone living room ceiling fixture. Maybe he's right, Tommy said, fed up. He never asked for their help, hadn't invited them to visit. Maybe it is haunted.
Daddy.
Maggie's eyes filled with tears. She bit her lip.